Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. A little technical difficulty getting us on tonight, so we're going to go a little bit longer because we're starting late. But late is okay as long as we can continue the show, and we can do so. Okay, so if you have, by the way, this is your show for metaphysics and spirituality, and if you have any questions, thoughts, comments while we're on the air, you can call in at 877-876-5227 in the U.S. And for those of you in Canada, try 888-815-9756. And again, tonight we're going to continue on with what our living planet is about and how life actually develops in a metaphysical sense. And the thing I love about this is I can just yak and yak and yak. I don't really have to worry much about time. Because as we close out each show, I can say, well, we didn't get this done, we didn't get that done, so I can just keep going. Next week, that is. So this is a nice part about having a series of shows that covers a subject in a more widely, we'll say, encompassing way, that I can go deeper into things and even diverge and go off into who knows where and talk about who knows what. I know last week I think I was talking about dinosaurs for a while. Don't know where I got into that, but whatever, you know, they're very interesting, and we actually reach a point where I can talk about them, and it actually fits into that particular week's subject area. And I want to mention that in terms of how life is developed on Earth, and most planets, it's done by a focus of, we'll call it life energy, some people call it ray energy, that develops life in a progression, and the progression is based upon how many out of seven of these types of energies are focused on the planet at one time. And there is a thing called a round. Some people refer to it as a round. It's actually a very focused development of life in a combination of, we'll say, these energies focused on the planet. And it starts off with just one energy, and then two energies, and then three energies, and then four energies, and eventually five, six, and seven. And that's the total number of energies that are focused on the planet at one time. So in the very beginning, life starts out very slowly. It takes a very long time to develop, because only one out of seven energies is focused on the planet, and that one type of energy makes up the first round. Then the second round has two types of energy, and the third round three, and on and et cetera. It actually, these energies are added in a progression that has to do with their numerical value. So the first type of energy has a numerical value of one. You might say, well, what does that correspond to? It actually corresponds to the very first part of our Creator's thought and also of its mind. So what is the first part of our Creator's thought has to do with creation itself, freedom, purpose. Hey, that sounds interesting, huh? And also, we'll call it the ability to go both create and destroy some parts of life when necessary. It is a type of energy, some people call it first ray type energy, that when it floods the planet more often than not, is effective at the act of creation itself. And the interesting thing is that life becomes a force, we'll call it, in producing changes on our planet when it is dominated by this first ray type of energy. And if it's done for the entire quote-unquote period of time where only one energy was focused on our planet, which is actually what took place at the beginning of the development of our planet, and for several billion with a B, years after that, life actually is focused on creating changes in our planet itself for future life. So life becomes not only an effect from the planet's development, and such as things as I mentioned last week, the inner core of our planet and how it changes where various parts of land are because it's moving the surface of the Earth, as well as things like the sun and how much the sun is intense in its focus on Earth and how much it affects the climate of Earth and changes the way Earth is developing at any particular time. But it acts like a third part of the whole system. You have the Earth and the sun, but you also have life itself eventually changing the planet. You might say, well, how does it do that? Well, the interesting thing is that it sort of starts from the standpoint that the life has an extremely small effect that is gargantuan over time because each life form is extremely minuscule because it's microscopic, but collectively it has a huge effect on the eventual development of the kind of atmosphere that the planet is going to be surrounded by. And this change in atmospheric conditions is so great that during the entire, we'll call it first round, or the first time that life itself was having an effect on our planet, it changed radically the kind of life that eventually could live on the planet. Life itself was changing the planet. And changing it in a huge way, but over a very long period of time, from zillions of life forms adding a very small effect, but collectively having a huge effect on future life. I hope I'm not confusing anybody, but it's a little complicated. I find it fascinating that life itself is ultimately changing the planet. And you might say, well, why is it like that? Why would any creator of a planet or a universe or whatever want to have the life itself change the places where life is going to live, which we call planets, so that new life could be developed? And the answer is part of this first ray, this first type of energy, is to imbue in life in itself part of the creator. And that imbuing, that aspect of its own development, is to become a creator, and to become a creator in a large way, that the very planet it exists on, it ultimately changes that planet into becoming something that can support a new kind of life from its own beginnings. Now, many people might say, well, isn't that kind of like similar to evolution? Well, it is. Evolution is not separate from God, but it's the basis of evolution and some other quirky things about evolution that if you don't include the creator in the process, evolution has some contradictions and problems within itself. When you do, it makes so much sense that you wouldn't want to throw it out. You'd say, oh, well, it's supposed to be that way. So it kind of is that we're only seeing a small fraction of what evolution is when we study it in today's biology, or even 100 or 150 years ago when it was first proposed by Darwin. But you see, we don't have a big enough grasp. It isn't that we are too entrenched in evolution. It's that we don't have the big picture of how it's really working. And that's what I hope to be developing in these shows, metaphysically speaking, in trying to reveal how evolution works hand-in-hand with the plan of our Creator. And that's the whole point of it. If you don't agree with it, you can call in and talk to me about it on either side. If you don't believe in evolution, or if you think evolution is completely a mechanical model that doesn't need a Creator in order to work, we can have a discussion about it. I would love to do that with anybody who wants to so choose to. Now, the interesting thing about this is that as our planet evolved, during the first few billion years, that's a long, long time, these little microscopic organisms that generally had one cell were sometimes collectively developing among themselves the ability to become super creators and to change the very nature of what we would refer to as the macro environment of our planet. In the beginning, the atmosphere of Earth had virtually zero, almost zero oxygen, the thing that we breathe and live on ourselves. because although there's a lot of nitrogen, even more so, in the air, it's pretty much inert to us. It's great for plants, and they love it. But it isn't all that terrific for human beings, other than it's just sort of like there. You know, it's okay, doesn't bother us. We don't mind it having lots of nitrogen in the air around us, and we share this with our plants. But we require oxygen. Well, the interesting thing is that these early life forms, they didn't need oxygen, not at all. They weren't really into it. They said, "Oh, oxygen, that's not good for me." They were into actually a cycle of energy that, to some extent, was not even. And many people think it was carbon based. It was like carbon dioxide, but in reality, that isn't the fact. They used, in many cases, sulfur. Talk about strange. Yeah, they used sulfur and some other chemistry that tended to result in odd kinds of chemical reactions within themselves. Some of them actually also used iron, which is strange, as a basis for reducing and changing chemical reactions with very little oxygen. A lot of people say, oh, wasn't the sulfur like sulfur dioxide, which has an oxygen factor? Actually, not necessarily. It depends on which one of those little one-celled creatures you're talking about. But many of them didn't. Some of them also didn't, almost none of them required anything to do with light. They weren't dealing with photosynthesis, which is a more complicated reaction and does require some carbon issues, and there is some oxygen actually involved in the process, but it's not the primary part of it. So these early life forms were actually living off of very different kinds of chemistry than what we're used to. Unfortunately, that type of chemistry is relatively inefficient, the ones that they're using, and some of them required very high levels of heat in order to work. That the heat is because they were so inefficient. So some of these life forms lived at the bottom of the oceans, next to what we call volcanic smokers, or the parts of the earth where some of the mantle is heating up the crustal lines and getting it really hot, like hundreds and hundreds of degrees, maybe 700 or more degrees Fahrenheit. And these creatures can live there. Well, it's hard for us to understand that because we'd say, well, anything would just be destroyed by so much heat. They kind of stayed a little bit away from it, maybe could live in a couple hundred, 250 degrees heat. And they used all this energy in the heat to make these relatively inefficient chemical reactions kind of go, and to be able to sustain a type of life metabolism. There are still some types of extreme types of life forms that still can live in those environments today. They are no longer the primary emphasis of the development of life, but they sustain themselves through this first round period and continue to be able to live in these very strange environments. Now, the interesting part of this is that there still is, and there still was, a little bit of oxygen that was being produced, both in strictly a mineral sense and also from some of the little life forms that existed. And this little bit of oxygen gradually over time, we're talking about a billion years or so, built up in our atmosphere. First, in many cases, just in the water that it was in, and then it gassed out of the water and would enter the oxygen, enter the atmosphere. Some of it joined with carbon and became carbon dioxide. Some of it became just free-floating oxygen. And a lot of it stayed in the oceans before, you know, other than just outgassing. So we had some oxygen levels in the surrounding atmosphere, and maybe even more oxygen. This is very important in the oceans themselves. Now, as oxygen started to develop, it allowed some creatures to say, hey, you know what? I don't have to live in as hot a place. I could maybe move around. I can maybe have closer communication with the surrounding little microcellular forms of life that are around me, and to join in and become an integrated system, because I can more quickly sense and more quickly communicate with these other cells by using oxygen. So oxygen really became like the catalyst for life moving from this first round of life development, where only literally a very minimal amount of interaction took place between one type of cellular organism and another, or between cells of the same organism. They could maybe form some kind of primitive colony, but they really couldn't do much more than that. And the primitive colony, of course, in its very earliest life form, sometimes just increased their temperature, allowing them to be a little bit more efficient, but not able to necessarily use oxygen very well. But eventually, enough oxygen gathered around, maybe a couple percent inside the oceans, and maybe 1 to 2%, 1 to 1.5% that would outsource into the atmosphere, to allow some of these organisms to start collectively being able to develop a sense of other organisms, and we'll call it a second sense of awareness of themselves and others and the difference between the two. Once an organism can know the difference between itself and something other than its not-self, it started to develop into the second part of God's mind, which we call consciousness. It's a very, very, very minimal level of consciousness in these original one-celled animals to be able to do this. But it's enough to say that at that point, we're getting close to the beginning of the second round of development of life on our planet, where two, rather than one type of brain energy is going to be focused on the planet. You might say, well, when did that happen? About 600 million years ago is when that took place. So from about 4.1 billion years ago until about 600 million years ago, the planet was really only dealing with one type of energy at a time. And the dominant energy was this first ray type of energy. But there were periods when that energy would be substituted with one of the other six types of energy to stimulate life to grow in a very different way and to develop a kind of diversity to life over time. Although the first type of energy would, again, be the most dominant, the most prevalent, because it's always the case. Whatever the round is, the type of energy that corresponds to that round allows that energy to dominate within the types of life that exist. And I hope I'm not losing you on this, because it gets confusing, I know, for some people. Many people have never heard of this before, and they say, well, what is he talking about? Well, hopefully you'll understand it. Another way to look at it is sense, and it's in terms of senses. When I talk about energy, so it has to be a corresponding sense that is developed in life in order for that energy to do anything. Some of us refer to our sense centers metaphysically as chakras. So one way to look at this, another way to look at this, is that the types of life that existed during the first round of the planet usually only had one chakra, one sense. Most of the life, the majority of it, had a sense only of creation and how to function in a way that allowed it to be free to exist and free to be more creative of itself. So it did a lot of creating of we'll say, itself through asexual, usually, forms of dividing and becoming more of itself. That was the most common type of sense. But over the billions of years, because the planet has to diversify its life, the sources of this energy, which are cosmic, we'll call them sources, focused the other types of energy one at a time on Earth, less often than the first type of energy, which we call first ray type of energy, being focused. But when these other types of energies were focused, a new type of life usually sprung up because it developed a different sense. And it only had one. It only had one sense. But some of these other life types, these little one-cell creatures, had new sense of life. Maybe a fifth ray sense, maybe a fourth Rebbe, maybe a seventh, maybe a sixth. And they've started to develop some uniqueness to themselves, while the dominant form of life still had a first-rate sense. Interesting, isn't it? None of these forms of life are really what we will call in any way conscious. But about 600 million years ago, some creatures started to develop a second sense. So instead of having just one sense, they had two. With two senses, these life forms suddenly could become aware of the difference between who they were and who everything else was around them. That really makes a difference. It starts delineating the difference between this is me and that's you. That's a big, big difference in a world that for billions of years didn't have life that knew the difference between this is me and that's you. There's just us, and I don't know what that is, so I'll just forget about it and create more of us. So that's what life was like before the beginning of the second wind. So for about 30 to 50 million years, gradually there was a shift in Earth from the first round to the second. It was preceded by a thing called a snowball event, of the second one actually on the planet, in which the whole planet became like a snowball, became frozen in time, frozen in everything, which forced life to develop itself in unique ways. It kind of crunched it together and put it into environments in which it had to become more supportive of itself in order to survive the extreme conditions on the outside, which were very, very cold, and with virtually no possibility of living anywhere except virtually inside the Earth itself. And life actually developed there at the very fringes of where it could possibly exist. And this life became quite tenacious, but also it got crunched together. And it started to develop a second sense. The second sense was of itself versus other life. And as soon as the snowball effect melted away, which took about maybe 10 million years or so, this life then was free to get back into the oceans, which now were not frozen, and start to join with other cells in a much more prosperous environment. And also, the oxygen levels had risen even before the snowball event, allowing them to be able to develop the second center more effectively, because in order to do so, they had to have the ability to sense at a higher level. They had to do it in a way that had to be biochemically compatible with what the surrounding Earth was, and in this case, there was enough oxygen finally to allow it. So suddenly, there was the advent, give or take about 590 million years ago, of the ability for some life forms to literally develop a colony of cells within themselves that weren't just there to make more of themselves, but were there to delineate the differences between one side of themselves and the other side, between the right and the left, between up and down, and eventually between themselves and other life forms. Now, once this happens, you have the beginning of some life forms that are, we'll call them the nonviolent types, the types that just want to hang around and kind of suck in nutrients from the ocean itself. And then some life forms that say, you know, those suckers that are around there sucking in the ocean, they look like they would be tasty. I think instead of sucking in nutrients from the ocean, I'll suck on them instead. So now, because they had a consciousness of themselves versus other cells, other things, they said, I think I'll eat the other things. So we had the beginning of what we call, of course, the carnivorous or praying types of life forms, and the non-carnivorous life forms. Very interesting, and this all came about because there was more oxygen around, so that the communication within the organism and then between organisms increased dramatically, because oxygen speeds up the rate at which information can be had within a life form in its senses, and then it does something amazing. It provides locomotion. Oxygen is much more efficient at allowing life forms to be able to move because it has the ability to get the job done in terms of converting energy from one source to another very quickly, better than the surrounding types of energies that were available at the time. It also frees life forms to start creating some of their own heat, and they don't have to all hang out in a colony together, or they don't have to hang up next to a volcano or some other heat source. They can create it internally on their own. Sounds interesting, huh? I think it is. So this was the plan, you can say, by developing a thing called the second round, in which energy now was going to be flooding on our planet two at a time. Two of the types of ray energies are now going to be focused on Earth two at a time instead of one at a time, which allows organisms to develop both parts of God's thought and both parts of three parts of God's mind, allowing now there to be a kind of, we'll say, awareness and consciousness of themselves and other types of life. And it, within literally millions of years, not that long, in, not billions for sure, the oceans, we went from a thing called the Precambrian to the Cambrian Age, the oceans become teeming with all kinds of more complex forms of life that start to develop senses that we are familiar with. Each type of animal developed a couple of senses, in some cases the sense of sight, the sense of smell, the more complicated ability to sense touch in a specific way. And this is quite different than the life before, which only really had one active sense. It might have been each type of life had a somewhat different active sense, but nonetheless, it had one. And so two senses that were being developed and being balanced to each other made life in the Cambrian period amazingly interesting compared to these little one-celled, either colonies or individual-celled microbes that had been before. Now we suddenly have life that we're more used to, is saying, hey, that looks like it's a blank-blank. Because it had a blank-blank to look like. It had something to actually resemble. Very fascinating stuff. Well, I think we'll take a break at this particular time, and we're going to be going over about a little over 6 minutes at the end of the hour. So I ran a little bit heavily on this part of the show so that we balance out the two sides. So we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of. About romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Again, as usual, we're talking about metaphysics and spirituality. And today I'm going on with the series dealing with the subject of the life of Earth and how life developed on Earth, including even more today about how certain types of energies, ray energies, affected life in this world and how this is going to continue to be the case, and as more and more different kinds of ray energies out of seven are focused on the planet at the same time, life grows faster and more diverse and, in a way, more spiritual. We'll see that later on, possibly not today, but how we can really see how eventually, in order for God to be present in life, there has to be a dominating issue of how many of these types of ray energies actually are being focused on the planet and or used by life on the planet. Eventually, the focus of the rays are not as important as what the life is doing itself, and we saw the beginnings of this kind of thought in that life is actually developing the planet itself. Eventually, over time, rather than just the planet and the sun being the dominant issues. Yes, we do occasionally have a comet or asteroid hit us and other things that come about, but generally it's the Earth and the sun that are the big players. But eventually life itself becomes a big player. Either it's very small types of life that live for billions of years, or it's life like us that have only been here for millions of years, and in that small period of time, we have made huge changes in the planet because we aren't dependent just upon how many rays are focused on the planet at one time. We are dependent upon how we are going to change the planet ourselves more so than the ray focus, although it depends upon what we choose and how we choose to live. We'll get to all that. Now, let me continue with my Cambrian period oceans that so we're developing into really remarkable life forms for millions, well, tens of millions of years, that we're able to identify the difference between themselves as being one kind of life and other life, which was not themselves. And this was the beginning of consciousness. It is called the second round because in the second round, the second part of God's mind, the Creator's mind, becomes dominant, and we don't have just life creating more of itself, more life. We have life that's being able to distinguish between itself and other kinds of life. And so once that takes place, we have the advent of predator and prey. And we have a lot of other kinds of things happening in the oceans, which is where almost all life was existent on our planet. There weren't even, by the way, things that we could register or record as being truly plants. Although there were beginnings of life that looked like they were going to become more plant-like because they kind of stuck themselves to the bottom of the ocean and just grew there. Well, like plants do, but we wouldn't exactly call them plants at that particular time. And it's most interesting because there was kind of a combination of effects between animal and plant in life during the early parts of the Cambrian period. And some creatures in that those early oceans were almost composites. We would have trouble saying whether they really looked very much like animals or much like plants. They were kind of like something in between, and it's hard to say because they were starting to just just develop what we would call rudimentary elements in consciousness. Now, many people don't think plants are conscious, but they actually are, and I can prove that in a number of ways down the line as we go further in our discussion about life on Earth. But it is interesting that the amount of oxygen that was being used was the determining factor in the development of consciousness. And some of these life forms used a lot more oxygen than others. The ones that just kind of sat around and just absorbed stuff and eventually attached themselves to the bottom of the ocean, which became more towards plants in many respects, were using very minimal amounts of the added oxygen compared to the animals that are swimming around vigorously and going around nibbling on the other kinds of life forms and eventually killing them. I'm not saying killing is a good thing, but I'm just saying that that's what they did. And they did so because they were able to facilitate the use of oxygen more so within their centers than the ones that weren't doing that. So we had a kind of a separation, a kind of like a distinguishing between one kind of life and another. Eventually, about 530 million years ago, give or take, fish, as we first call them, started to appear, something that looked like fish anyway. And sometime between then and the next 20, 30 million years, fish became even more identifiable as fish. And it was fish that really kind of broke the mold on distinguishing themselves as more conscious kinds of life. They really were able to identify clearly who and what they were in comparison to what other kinds of life were. But interestingly, there was another kind of life form that also was developing itself, and it developed itself in consciousness that was a bit more separative than fish. Fish tended to identify their who they were collectively, besides who they were individually, whereas this other kind of life form mostly identified itself who it was individually and less collectively. That type of life form became what we later call insect type of life form, and especially once it left the oceans. And so this one type used oxygen mostly to individualize itself, but not to work together too closely with other types of life of similar form, and became mostly insect life, the beginnings of insect life within the oceans. Whereas the fish kind of life, actually some of the fish kind of life, became much more collectively able to live together and to develop a more, we'll say, social type of combined system. And this was gradual. It took tens of millions of years, but that's kind of the direction that these kinds of life forms that were using a lot more oxygen were doing. Very interesting. They were developing eyes. They were developing the ability to use multiple senses. They came to the ability to eventually alter their environment in some unique ways, not just collectively and averaging out the outpouring of gases, etc., but they would look for habitats and design these habitats to live within. Fish were better at doing this because they were able to identify better other members of themselves than were the kinds of life forms that eventually became insects. And then we had life forms that kind of just stuck themselves to the bottom still and didn't have a lot of movement. But some of them also became things that we today would call like sea urchin type of thing, animals, and also starfish. They had some limited, very limited type of movement. There was even life forms that developed some kind of coral type of environment that allowed them to build their own little place to live, but to still not have a great deal of mobility, of course, because we know that corals don't have that. But this all took place during this early Cambrian period of development. All of this was going on for, like, well, we can say 50, 60 million years. And all kinds of life forms that we are somewhat familiar with to some extent came into existence and prospered during this period of time. And Another thing that's very interesting about the early Earth, even going back, it isn't that early, of course, it isn't going back many billions of years, but even going back hundreds of millions of years, is that the day and night were at a different ratio. The planet was actually spinning at a different speed, and so what we think of as day and night today was actually happening several times in a day. Day and night was happening much more rapidly, and this had an effect on the ability for life to be able to live outside of the ocean. And until that slowed down a little bit, it was very difficult for life forms to be able to exist any place other than within the ocean. So they were kind of confined to the oceans, somewhat because the diurnal cycle of the Earth was pretty radical. Morning, it's been day, night, very quickly. Boom, boom, boom. Well, that doesn't give an animal a time to adjust to the environment and to find a habitat that it can exist in very easily. And even plants need a cycle longer than what existed, say, 450 million years ago. So there weren't any plants any place, on land. Actually, there was no life on land because of these crazy cycles. So it really wasn't a hospitable place. You could say, well, why is it? Was that like that? Because this is the design of the creator of our planet. It isn't because of just happen chance. It was because the planet developed the moon, and because the moon had an effect on the gravity, and because of all kinds of other things that were affecting us. And so ultimately, it controlled life to keep it in the ocean so it could develop itself a little bit slower and a little bit, we'll say, more in an environment of protection. Because to live outside of water requires even more adaptability, even more of the ability to understand itself in relationship to other life, and that means higher consciousness. So for life to really get outside the ocean, it had to develop this in well over 100 million years to reach a point where it could get out of the water, so to speak, and live on land in the air. Maybe it's part of the time in the air, if nothing else. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating. And all this is going on in order to foster the development in this particular time period of the consciousness of life. That was the big deal. The second round, unlike the first, which took billions of years, actually took several hundred million years. The second round lasted from about officially. It started in the Precambrian, like 620 million years, up to it started officially, completely, in an area of time called the Full Cambrian, which is the 570 million years ago, and it lasted to about 250 million years ago, which was called the Permian period. And during those hundreds of millions of years, life was focused on developing the ability to collectively understand who it was in comparison to other kinds of life forms, and to be able to develop a relationship with life that was similar to itself. Not necessarily different, but similar. And it did develop some relationship of understanding life that was different from itself, but oftentimes it used that to eat that of life or to compete with the other life in a forceful way. Because on our planet, as I talked about last week, we tend to have a very forceful way of developing life because it's quicker. We're in an accelerated mode. It allows life to develop all these traits that we're talking about today and others besides more quickly than on planets where it might take many times longer. Well, Earth didn't have the time because our particular star had already had a planet like Earth in an earlier incarnation of that star before it was the star itself in this incarnation, in an earlier incarnation, and it hadn't done too well. That planet had not survived. And it had dealt with evil similar to the ways that Earth is dealing with evil now, and it just didn't make it. The people that did eventually develop themselves, they went all the way up to making people. Those people ended up destroying that planet, and it turned out that the planet itself was doomed because it wasn't being successful at dealing with the evil that it had created through the existence of dark people that eventually lived on it. But this sun and planet didn't exist within our solar system. It existed in another part of this galaxy at a different time from what we're understanding at this point in time. And unfortunately, it was in the very earliest part of our galaxy in its development. And that earlier part of our galaxy wasn't as conducive to the development of a planet as it is today, probably because it was a more violent place and actually had an active, a massive black hole in the middle of it that was doing a lot of agitating of all of the stars and the systems, etc. It's probably a much more difficult place to develop any kind of life in. And so that system just didn't make it. But our sun continues on. It continues as a new development of itself, it will say, in a new form, in a more quiet part of the galaxy when the galaxy itself has settled down. And that started about, give or take, about 5 billion years ago. And the Earth, within a half a billion years, itself had formed. And so we're giving it another shot, but we have to go a little bit faster in order to keep up with things, because of the way that the plan for our planet is composed, and to allow our planet to eventually overcome certain types of evil. In order to do that, there has to be people. So we got to get people popping up here a few hundred million years earlier than would normally have taken place. That means you have to accelerate the entire process in order to do that, and make it happen so much faster. Everything in spiritual terms takes huge amounts of time, way more than what we're used to in thinking about our world and how we create things. Human beings are very fast in the way they create things once they're on a planet, but to get to the human stage usually takes longer than even took place on Earth. Let me continue now. All right, so we have the seas of life that cannot yet get out of the ocean because the day is moving too fast and the diurnal day is moving too fast with the nights, and it's complicated for life to be able to adapt to that, and very difficult because once it's getting used to sun one temperature with one type of energy level with the sun present, it then quickly has to adapt to a much colder energy level without the energy of the sun available. And life didn't find it very easy to deal with that until about 400 million years ago. Right then, give or take 10 million years, there were some types of life that managed to get out of the ocean, and that type of life actually was what we would call plants. And this type of life started to pump out, once it got out of the oceans and had free rein and there was nothing nibbling on it, it grew very quickly. And it was able to develop a very high oxygen atmosphere. And this very high oxygen atmosphere, along with the day growing longer in relationship to the diurnal change. In other words, night didn't come on so fast. The moon was moving further and further away from Earth, causing this effect. And the amazing thing about that is it all fit together with the way life was growing. Now you could say, well, it was all evolutionary, I said, and I would say, absolutely not, because if you didn't have these things happen in exactly this order, none of it could have happened. It could. You can't say, well, we'll just take this out. We won't worry about the fact that the moon suddenly, or not suddenly, but the moon was moving away, and it just coincided with the development of life, even though the two are not connected in any way in an evolutionary model, and yet, because of this, it allowed the development of life on out of the oceans and on to the surface of the planet, and eventually for plants to develop a lot higher levels of oxygen, highest actually ever that have existed on Earth, to develop. This is, like, amazing stuff. And we eventually reached an age called the Devonian Age. And during this period of time, you end up with the insect part of life that we had talked about earlier actually getting out of the oceans kind of first, you might say, and inhabiting all parts of the planet and becoming amazingly effective at developing themselves into quite large creatures, because although they don't have the kind of lungs we have, as long as there's super high levels of oxygen, they're the most efficient form of life to develop themselves. And this happened, you know, about 370, 380 million years to about 350 million years ago. He had these kind of life forms really taking over the non-ocean, the dry earth parts. There was also the fishes, which kind of were trying to catch up, you might say. They got into some of the more freshwater areas and developed into amphibians. And from amphibians, they were able to live some of the time out of water, but their skins were very sensitive to the sunlight, and they were also unable to procreate except in water, which kept them tied to being in water at least a significant period of time. And they started to learn, some of them started to learn how to eat some of the insects, but they were not successful completely because they had to have much, much tougher outside. They were kind of untough on the outside. And so they developed themselves into developing eventually very tough outsides. We call it a sort of fully developed skin. And some of that same ability to develop a very tough skin also became an ability to develop a tough layer around their eggs. And eggs could stay outside of water and still reach a state where they could develop into more of them of themselves, which could not be done with the amphibians. The amphibians had to keep their eggs in the water. And so we eventually have reptiles. And all of this took place within just a few tens of millions of years, amazingly, and very quickly. And also, a very interesting thing took place. The oxygen, as soon as the reptiles started coming into existence, the reptiles didn't need as much oxygen as the insects did. And I guess you could call it coincidentally, but I don't see it that way at all. The amount of oxygen started to decrease on the planet. And you could say, why did the oxygen decrease? Well, there's a couple of good reasons for it. First of all, to some extent, the insects, which are quite large, were using some of it. But even more so, there was changes in the chemistry of the Earth. The actual chemistry of the Earth and certain volcanic actions and other things did things that bound oxygen up in a chemical sense. And then in addition, plants which were fully abundant had to become challenged and balanced with some animal life, as well as they were reaching their peak. And the animal life was using up some of the oxygen while the plants couldn't make any more of themselves very easily. And so the results were, they were competing among themselves, both in height and the amount of photosynthesis they could create. And the process kind of reached a balancing point where oxygen actually dropped by about 10% or more. When this took place, the insects became smaller because they couldn't maintain their body size, and they also became less adaptable, while the amphibians and especially reptiles became much more capable of being able to challenge the environmental adaptations that the insects had done. So by 300 million years ago, we've got these reptiles running around, which are huge reptiles, but the insects are no longer capable of dominating the environmental niches that the reptiles could live in. And it was all because of changes in both the planet itself, the relationship of the sun to the planet, to some degree, I didn't mention that earlier, but also there were some changes in that. Tilt of the Earth changed a little bit. And again, the daytime versus nighttime changes are increasing because the moon is continuing to move away, making the day closer to the 24-hour day that we have today. It maybe wasn't 24 hours, it might have been 20, 21 hours, but it gave the advantage, actually, to larger life forms that didn't have to rely purely on high levels of oxygen to be able to survive. These life forms were more adaptable. Very interesting. And life, as all of this is happening, the amazing thing about this process is that life is becoming more and more conscious, more and more conscious. There's a vast difference between a reptile in its consciousness and an insect. Insects, again, have very limited consciousness in their ability to understand other fellow insects. Whereas, and that even includes ants and bees, which weren't around yet, by the way. They didn't exist then. But they're much more affected by their genetic structure and a thing I call group soul consciousness, rather than by on a individual level the ability to be conscious of themselves and other animals. Whereas reptiles, and to some lesser extent amphibians, are much more conscious beings. And so consciousness is reaching a peak. It's really developing faster and faster until about 250 million years ago, which was really the end of the second round. It was the peak, but yet also the end, the time when animals were focused on developing as much consciousness as possible, having two dominant centers. They had some other centers and other senses by this point, but they only had two dominant centers at a time, and only two types of energy were being pumped onto the planet to help develop the senses of animals and plants. Plants were also less complicated than they are today, but we would recognize them from, say, 275 million years ago. We could recognize some of those plants because they've been around that long, or at least kinds of them have been. So fascinating thing is happening now. We can see that the planet is intertwining itself with life, and between the two, more and more complicated kinds of life are being developed on Earth. Fascinating thing. Absolutely fascinating. And it's all based upon a plan to create life as quickly as possible in a certain order. The first order was to develop life that could create more life. Well, that's a good thing. And that took billions of years. And then life understanding itself and other life to some limited way through the use of its senses for hundreds of millions of years. That's the second round. And we're coming on now to the third, and I'm not going to have time to tell you about that because we're out of time for right now. But next week, guess what? We're going to go talk about the third round and how it developed. And I get finally to talk about dinosaurs, legitimately, and tell you more about those, and tell you how they developed and how they were different from other reptiles. They weren't the same thing. I know a lot of people like to say, oh, they were just another reptile. But they really weren't. They were something else entirely. Okay, so let me just mention this. For those of you who have a chance this Sunday, that's September 14th, tune in to 1170 a.m., and listen to me talk about the afterlife, part five. See, yeah, there's another one where I'm doing a series, see? And if you live in the Boston, Massachusetts, Norfolk, Providence, Rhode Island area, you could tune in. Just tune in to your AM radio and you can hear me. If instead, or if you don't live in those areas, you can listen to WDISAM.com, and just like you're listening right now on the internet, and you can hear me talk. And you can listen all you want. And also, on September 15th, which is, I believe, this coming Monday, from 7 p.m. to 8:15 p.m., you can go in here. Mimi, who is a member of a spiritual group that I'm a member of, speak about the science of dreams. Yes, the science of dreams. No charge to the public, of course. And here we talk at Borders Books and Music over at Mesa Fiesta, at 1361 South Alma School Road, and that's in the Phoenix area. Now, you got to be in Phoenix to go to this, but if you're going to be visiting Phoenix or if you live in Phoenix, come and visit her. She'd love to see you. Well, hopefully this has given you some ideas of how life is being developed on Earth through the rays, etc., and many people have asked me to explain it better and more, so I'm doing it, and hopefully has made some sense to you out there who are listening. So until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.